So can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
You have a weapon?
Yeah, a big one. How about you?
You sure you want to get cute with me? You have a backup weapon?
Never had the need.
Get one. Keep that in your suit unless I tell you to take it out. Get yourself a Glock. Lose that nickel-plated sissy pistol.
And on the eighth day, God made the farmer. But he was not done. He looked down on the wilds of his untamed earth and said, I need someone who will never be broken. And so his greatest work began. First he filled their belly full of guts and their hearts full of try. Then he called them a cowboy. He needed someone who could handle a horse, teach them, tame them, but never break them. Someone whose soul needed the saddle and would not change with the world around them. So God made a cowboy. He needed someone who could find a hot bull in a 100-section pasture, ride a bronc, hold a family together, read a brand, let wrongdoings go and pull a tight cinch. God needed someone who didn't mind dusty cow pens, smoking branding irons, long days and cold nights. So God made a cowboy. It had to be someone who could make a living with their rope, cow dog, and a few good horses. Someone who would never know a 40-hour week nor care to. He needed to create a proud man, one who would take a stand and whose greatest compliment would be to have his kids called handy. So God made a cowboy. But after he created the cowboy, he was far from done. While his creation was tough and untamed, they need more than just a good horse to share their name. And no ordinary woman would understand the cowboy. God needed to create a woman who didn't want store-bought roses by the dozen, but rather wild flowers, seldom picked and sweet cowboy loving. He needed someone who could take a good custom in the working pens, love unconditionally, and forgive. Someone who could open her own doors, sweep tack room floors, look past muddy boots into kitchen floors, make a home, hold her own, and have an eye for a good horse. Someone who didn't need lavish and flattery, but would find joy in a spring-born colt. Someone who could raise babies, fix fence, patch jeans, and never waver in the hard times of a cowboy life. So God made a cowboy's wife. And when God fashioned the cowboy and his wife, he made them in his exact image and likeness, and bless them for all their earthly life. Welcome to the Shooting Bench on Survival Circle Radio Network, keeping you informed on guns, news, politics, guns, survival, preparedness, and guns. The tyrant is holding our country hostage, and our freedom is at stake. It's time to take a stand and tell the tyrant, we will not comply. Join me now in the never-ending fight against tyranny, right here on the Shooting Bench. And here we are, and welcome to the Shooting Bench. It's Monday, the 22nd of August. Hope everybody had a great weekend. We had a pretty good weekend. I spent some time Saturday, much needed time that I haven't done in a long time. I didn't do near enough of it, but I went out shooting for no other reason than to be shooting. Well, that's not true. I was tuning up a little bit with my 10-22s and my Ruger Mark IIs because Shoot the Deuce is coming up. Remember, year before last, we talked about Shoot the Deuce. I missed it last year. Shoot the Deuce is a competition that's put on here in Sholo every year, and it's sponsored by Ruger, and some of the prizes are Ruger guns and accessories and gun cases and stuff. Remember, my son and I just about cleaned house. Not quite. We went in there completely cold. We had no idea what to expect whatsoever, and the only thing we did was go make sure the guns were sighted in, and that was all we could do. We had no idea what to expect, and we went in there, and we got, I don't remember what place we got, but I think Wes got, I think he got first, or between the two of us, we got a combined first. I don't remember what it was, but anyway, he wound up with a Ruger 22-45, and I got a gift certificate for something in town, and also a real nice Ruger case designed, I mean, it's made perfectly for a 10-22 with a scope on it. So, but anyway, I'm going to hit it again this year, and just kind of getting ready for that. I'm going to spend, it's on September the 10th, so any of you that's in the area that want to get in on that, it's a lot of fun. You don't have to go out there and just go out there and have fun. Don't go out there and be intimidated or don't worry about competing. Just go have fun. Go shoot. You may surprise yourself. But it's a lot of fun anyway. So also, this coming Wednesday, day after tomorrow, Doc and I are going to get together again in the second half of the show and talk about one of America's greatest guns. We'll let you know what that is when we talk about it. But it's a great gun, one that we both love, and we don't have any disagreements on it. We just want to talk about different things. No, long slide. I don't think the Glock shoots are intimidating at all. The matter of fact, we've got one coming up in Phoenix here in October. I may try to make it down there too. That depends on what else is going on. We do have a class coming up in Moriarty, New Mexico, 22nd, no, as you were, 23rd, 24th, and 25th of next month. And that'll be the 3-day personal defense handgun class with a night shoot. And I think it's going to be, they're always a lot of fun. I don't have to think. They're always fun. We always have a blast doing that that particular class. So, and the rest of September is pretty well used up. We've got the third weekend. I'm got dedicated to some stuff going on. I think we're having shotgun shoot, kind of a little trap competition with some of the church guys on the third weekend. Second weekend, what's going on the second weekend? Something, I'll have to look at my calendar. And first weekend is Labor Day, and I may be going to, I'm not sure exactly where we're going. I've got two or three different things planned on here. But anyway. Okay, well, you guys notice I haven't played it for a little while. I played the national anthem during the
during the opening there. And I just want to mention to everybody, I don't know if you saw this on Facebook or not, and I'll probably mention it again. I was so moved by this guy, Second Lieutenant Sam Kendricks. I'm sure we'll talk about it one more time before it fades away. But Second Lieutenant Sam Kendricks was right in the middle of a pole vault run. I mean, he was had his pole at the ready position there and was running just as hard as he could go towards the deal there where he jumps and he slammed on the brakes. The national anthem came on and he just come to a screeching halt, dropped that pole on the ground, snapped to attention. And as he should. And he was, I believe he's Army Reserve. And Army Reserve, 655th Transport Company, and a graduate of Ole Miss. So, hats off to Lieutenant Sam Kendricks. That was an awesome show of discipline and patriotism and respect. And I was very pleased with that. All right. Lots of stuff going on. We're going to try to go through these, try to get as many of them out of the way as we can. This one, unrelated to everything that we normally do, but it is outdoor stuff, and in some ways I think it is related to liberty, to freedom. And that is the fact that they can't keep these stupid wolves under control. You know, if they wish to save them and make a big deal out of it, they need to figure out how to fund it, because I don't want my tax money going to this, because I don't care about the wolves. I can't express to you in words, in the English language, doesn't have the right words for me to express how much I don't care about wolves. I mean, I do not care. And that we have a tremendous problem with wolves in Arizona and New Mexico, particularly with cattle. And I do have pictures of a dog that was devoured over around Luna a couple years ago, three or four years ago. But in Wisconsin right now, pet dogs seems to be the meal of the day here for wolves. As of right now, the total number of known pet dogs killed or injured by wolves just this year, this is the eighth month of this year, there's been 26 dogs that they know of. And as the season goes along, I'm sure that they can expect more of their dogs to be killed, as these wolves have more free range, and it's letting the packs are increasing, getting larger, and this dog situation here has become an epidemic out of Wisconsin. August 5th of this year, two weeks ago, Wildlife Services confirmed that wolves injured a 7-year-old walker hound in the town of Solon Springs in Douglas County. The next day, Wildlife Services, I guess that's what they call their game and fish department, confirmed that wolves killed a 2-year-old walker hound and a 2-year-old walker plot hound in the town of Delta, in Bayfield County. The 12th of August, they confirmed that wolves killed a 3-year-old, boy, they love walkers, the 3-year-old walker hound. It was killed on 8/12/16. I don't know if they mean the wolf or the dog, but the dog, I guess. The next day, they confirmed that wolves killed a 4-year-old walker again. The next day, no. Same day, they confirmed that wolves killed a 2.5-year-old black and tan and a 2.5-year-old blue tick. Both of them killed on the 13th of August. Same day. They confirmed that wolves killed a 4-year-old plot hound as it was killed on the 13th. That is, how many plots was that? There's one, two, let's see. Oh, maybe it's the walkers. It's a 1, 2, 3, 4. Four walkers, two plots, a black and tan, and a blue tick in 8 days in Wisconsin. And I said, I don't mind them reintroducing the wolves. As long as they can figure out how to do it without spending tax money, and as long as they don't mind me killing them when I see them, then I don't care what they do. They can put as many of them out there as they want to, as long as they can figure out how to do it without charging the taxpayers for it. This is up in, I believe this is up into Tinker's neck of the woods there. There's one of the first comment here said, this just seems like another way to not only promote the sale of firearms, but also a reason to exterminate more animals. Yeah, well, that's, works for me. I'm okay with that. All right, let's move along here and see if we can get some of these other ones out of the way. In Washington, D.C., you guys remember the anti-gun police chief there? What was her name? Lanier, Kathy Lanier? Well, the... named as a, let me let them tell you here. Let's see if we can make this thing work a little better than it did a while ago. No, that's too long. Never mind. She named it as a defendant in numerous Second Amendment lawsuits over the years. They've sued her, you know, numerous gun groups and individuals have sued her, the police chiefs of D.C. She's taken a job now in security for the NFL. She's retiring. She's getting out of the police chief business. And she was, she's been there 26 years. She's leaving effective September 17th to become the senior vice president for security operations for the NFL. She said, I never thought I'd have the opportunity to be the chief of the nation's capital. No place in the world deserves a sense of safety more than the nation's capital, and I feel like the transition for me now to the FFL, it's America's favorite sport, and that also deserves the same degree of same sense of safety. Well, I'm not sure that everybody in D.C. actually felt that safe while she was the police chief. She was rabidly anti-gun, if I remember. In 2013, her department advised lawful gun owners in the city that they had to re-register their firearms, or face criminal charges punishable up to $1,000 and a year in jail, or both, and receive a new ID card that had to be updated every 3 years. The next year, in 2014, she asked gun owners to register once again to re-register after the department lost part of the electronic fingerprint database. The chief in charge of the department when the pro-gun Heller decision was handed down by the Supreme Court, she was named in her official capacity in a host of subsequent lawsuits over the city's continued ban on concealed carry. Once federal courts struck down the city's ban on concealed carry, the chief strictly enforced D.C.'s rules until the city established a draconian may-issue permitting scheme under which the chief only granted 8 permits, rejecting most applicants. This in turn led to more lawsuits and a federal judge to hold the city's good reason requirement for a gun permit to be likely unconstitutional. Well, this is, we've talked about several things that's gone on in D.C. I'm not going to go through this whole story, but there's a good little taster there for you. But glad to see her leaving there, frankly. All right. Well, let's let me get my notes in order here. Let me see here just a second. And I'll be R.A.P. right back. To another segment of the Shooting Bench, right here on the Survival Circle Radio Network. All right, we're back. We got a little warning here a few days ago from the Northeast Arizona Public Information System saying that it's time to take time to get a flu vaccine. Few points of information from our friends at the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program. And by their way of thinking, the single best way to protect against the flu is to get vaccinated each year. Everyone 6 months and older should get vaccinated. This is so ridiculous to me. I know a few people that have gotten their flu vaccinations. I have had one in my life, and that was in 1993 in Atlanta, Georgia. I wasn't quite as knowledgeable as I am now, although I hadn't had one up until that point either. But the guys that I was working for there, the company I was working for, said, "We'll pay for it, but we want you to go get one. We can't afford to have you down. We want you to get a flu shot." And they finally talked me into it. And I didn't, if it had been today, I'd have told them to go pound sand. I wouldn't even have considered it for a minute. But they talked me into it, and sure enough, I didn't get the flu. But I was also drinking a bunch of that kombucha every day, twice a day sometimes. And of course, since 1998-99, I've been on colloidal silver every day. And my kids have been on colloidal silver every day, and my wife has been on colloidal silver every day, and my mother's been on colloidal silver every day, and my sister's been on colloidal silver every day. A great many of my friends and relatives have been on colloidal silver every day. And pretty much, as far as best of my knowledge, none of us have gotten the flu. I can remember two times that I've been sick since 1998. Or 99, whatever I said. 99, I think. Two times. No, it actually was 98. It was 98 because it was prior to my debut in the Y2K field there. And so that would have been 98 when I first moved to New Mexico from Arizona. And I've been sick twice, and one of those, I don't know that silver helped any. It was it certainly didn't hurt anything, but it was very, very short-lived. Something hit me. We'd been out to eat somewhere. I don't even remember where. And something hit me hard immediately. And in a matter of probably less than 10 minutes, it was gone. It hit me hard, and I puked my guts out. And then it was over. It was just a few minutes, a couple of sessions there. And it was all gone. So I think that was, to me, quite obviously, it was something that I had eaten. And I threw it up and it was gone, and that was okay. The silver may or may not have helped there. The other time was Thanksgiving Day of, 2016. It must have been 2014. 2013, 2014, I don't remember. Probably, maybe 13. Anyway, whenever it was, it doesn't matter. Whatever I got into that day, had it lasted biggest part of a day. And so, but as far as being sick for 2 or 3 weeks, like the flu puts people down and stuff like that, not once. Nor have my kids, any of my kids, ever. We've just our entire family, including Amy. You know, Amy once in a while she'll get I think it's from nerves or something, but once in a while she gets to feel a little bad. Never, usually doesn't last more than a few hours. We might have had it last a full day one time, I don't remember. But it's always been very, very minor. And I attribute every bit of it to colloidal silver. I have no need whatsoever to take a flu shot. They say the single biggest way to protect against it is to get vaccinated. The CDC recommends a yearly flu vaccine as the first and most important step in protecting against flu viruses. While there are many different flu viruses, a flu vaccine protects against the viruses that research suggests will be the most common. Okay, so it doesn't help against all of them. It just helps the ones that they think will be the most common. So it still doesn't mean that you're not going to get one of the other ones, even if this were to help with the ones that they expect. Colloidal silver, on the other hand, is all-inclusive. It does not discriminate against flu viruses. It kills all of them equally. Flu vaccination can reduce flu illness, doctor's visits, and missed work and school due to the flu, as well as prevent flu-related hospitalizations. Well, the jury's still out on that. It may or it may not. I think it depends on the individual and depends on the type of flu. It depends on what you eat. It depends on your own personal immune system. It depends on a whole bunch of different things. And I'm just not convinced that the vaccination itself is all that in a bag of chips. Let's see, that's redundant there. It says everyone 6 months of age and older should get the flu vaccine as soon as the current vaccines are available. Okay, I think we pretty much covered that already. Vaccination of high-risk persons is especially important to decrease their risk of severe flu illness. Now, that doesn't say what high-risk persons are, but I'm going to say that that's people with reduced immune systems, people, elderly, people that are, you know, kind of sickly anyway, the youth. I'm assuming that that's what they're meaning by that. Vaccination are important for people at high risk of serious, and now they're going to tell us on the next one. High risk of serious flu complications include young children, pregnant women, people with chronic health conditions like asthma, diabetes, or heart and lung problems, and people 65 years or older. Vaccination also important. You know, there's a whole bunch of them here, and you guys don't need to hear all of these. Try to avoid close contact with sick people. Yeah, I do that anyway. It has nothing to do with the flu. Gives you some advice here, covering your nose and mouth when you sneeze or cough. Wash your hands often with soap and water. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Germs spread that way. Clean and disinfect it. And take colloidal silver, although it doesn't say that. I think they accidentally left that part out. It should have been one of the bullet points here. Maybe one of the, probably the first, or maybe the last, or maybe both, should be take plenty of colloidal silver often, I think is what that's supposed to be. So anyway, well, we'll see what happens here. Well, there's no good deed should go unpunished. And this guy here had stopped to, this was in Charleston, South Carolina. These kind of stories really piss me off. But this guy stopped here, a good Samaritan stopped to help two teenagers, 17-year-old and a 19-year-old. The guy stopped to help them pull their SUV out of the ditch and got killed for his efforts. They say they stopped to help the teens pull their Dodge Durango out of a ditch. After the vehicle was back on the road, they say they robbed this good Samaritan and then fatally shot him. Police later tracked the teens down and arrested them in an area apartment complex. Not sure how they tracked them down or how they went about it, but I'm glad that they did. And there's just so many stories like this where people have stopped to help, people have been killed, injured, robbed, raped, whatever, because they trusted people, because they feel that that there's good in all people, I guess. Kilogram, yeah, I know that was sarcasm, because I know you're a fan of silver, have been for a long time. As a matter of fact, I just got an order today for another silver kit here. And the long slide, you know, I've said that I don't know how many hundred times on this show, but you're absolutely correct. Colloidal silver has the potential to absolutely destroy big pharmaceutical companies, just destroy them, not damage them, destroy them. And I've said this, and I don't know how many more times I'll say it, and I've said it many, many, many times. If I had the means to transfer the knowledge that I have about colloidal silver to 300 and whatever million people there is in this country, that the big pharmaceutical companies would be closing their doors in 30 to 60 days. It'd be done. There'd be somebody staying open for, aspirin and Tylenol and birth control pills and stuff, but all this other crap would take by and large, the biggest part of it would be gone. So, and I'm absolutely a firm believer in that. There's Peanut Rider mentioned something about fires up there, and I forgot to mention that, but there is there's 10, at least 10 fires going on up in Washington. And funny thing about this is, and I don't know if it's just coincidence, if it just happened that way, but remember there was, a few years ago, there was a promise at some point in the future of a fire jihad. And there were these 10 fires all started, from what I understand from another private conversation, that all these fires started in the same day. Now, one of them has been attributed to an electrical fire. And I haven't heard about the other nine. Maybe some of the folks from Washington in here on the chat can... maybe Yakima Glock or Longslide or somebody knows something about that. But, Kilogram, you're right. There's silver wound patches. I make my own. I don't go get them from anywhere. It's easy enough. Longslide says artillery fire. I don't know if that was all of them or just a few or just one or what. But I make the silver deal. What I do is take a little bit of Vaseline and put some silver in with it in a small container and just stir the hell out of it. And it will mix to a point. It'll get kind of milky white looking. And you can use that and put it on a piece of gauze or a Band-Aid or anything and put that on a cut, a burn, rash, scrapes, whatever, and it will make a huge, huge difference. Vaseline is something that absolutely should have in your medicine cabinet. There are some people, Amy doesn't care for it too much, being a petroleum product, but I tell you what, it's been used for generations for burns and stuff like that. It is probably one of the top treatments for quite a few different ailments, primarily burns, and mixed with a little bit of silver, and it's a great deal. You can take some of that stuff and again take a pill bottle or a yes, it is a good sealant, Kilogram. Put in a pill bottle or a 35 millimeter film container or something like that, and squish some gauze in there and just squish it in there and pack it in there real good, and just drop that in your first aid kit or in your backpack or whatever, and keep that stuff handy, and I promise you that it will be worth every few pennies that you spend on that. Radio Doc, again, you're correct. Colloidal silver is the absolute number one, top, most painless, most effective way to get rid of warts. Promise you that. My poor daughter, my oldest daughter, had warts all over her hand. And, Yakima Glock, you can still get them on Amazon. Had warts all over, I think just one hand. It may have been both, but I think it was just one hand. And she walked around, kept her hand closed all the time. She was embarrassed to death. And she just wouldn't do anything about it. She finally was convinced to go. We tried burning them off. We tried freezing them off. She just wouldn't go with the needle to inject silver into the right into the wart. Now, if you take a wart and after a good hot bath and scrub the top of it off while it's soft and put silver on it, it will take it away, and it'll take it away fairly quickly. But if you take a small needle like an insulin syringe and inject it right into the wart in two or three places around there, it will knock it out there in just a few days. And to this day, she has not had a single wart come back on her hands or anywhere else as far as that goes. But they've been completely clear since then. And that was back, she's 20, I think 22 now. That was back when she was about 14. And I know I've told you guys that story before, but it's been a long time, and there's new listeners, so I thought I'd share it with you. Peanut Rider says, I read that law enforcement in southern Arizona found a site where would-be jihadists were testing IDs. No, I have not heard anything about that. However, I don't think it's anything new. I think that they have, this has been an issue down there. Not anything that's cost any lives or caused any injuries of any kind, but I think it's been something that they have discussed and dealt with before. But even if this is the first time, it's certainly not any surprise, because there are a lot of Middle Easterners come through those same areas. Back when I was with Ranch Rescue, we had pictures of Middle Eastern military officials with Mexican police officials standing literally right on the border, on the edge of the river, standing beside a police vehicle. I know that they were, and why else would they be there? Well, anyway, we'll be back here in just a second. Maybe a few seconds, actually.
If you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band. That lead guitar is hot, but not for Louisiana man. So raw's enough that both of they need love, and let's all dance. If you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band. I remember down in Houston, we were putting on a show, when a cowboy in the back stood up and yelled, "Hot Night Joe!" He said, "We love what you're doing, boys, don't get us wrong. There's just something missing in your song. If you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band. That lead guitar is hot, but not for Louisiana man. So raw's enough that both are faded love, and let's all dance. If you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band." So we dusted off our boots and put our cowboy hats on straight. Them Texans raised the roof when Jeff opened up his cage. You say y'all all want a two-step, you say you want a do-si-do. Well, here's a fiddling song before we go. If you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band. That lead guitar is hot, but not for Louisiana man. So raw's enough that both are faded love, and let's all dance. If you're gonna play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band. In the band, that lead guitar is hot, but not for Louisiana man.
I mean, it's downright sickening to watch this. You know, you can get these white folk all riled up here. I'm going to tell you something. They're going to come in, the white folk get riled up, you know. Members of the NRA going to come into the black neighborhoods. I'm telling you. You know, the people going to get, people just tired of this. White people are being pushed around, kicked to the curb, having their rights denied, being called a racist, being walked on. Watching their tax dollars go to fund all kind of drug sales, prostitution, illegal immigration. I mean, y'all going to push these white folk till they can't take it no more. I'm telling you. You fool around here with Obama? You're going to let this long-legged Mac Daddy push these white folk? They're going to come up out of Tennessee and come up out of Oklahoma, come up out of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, come up out of Oregon and come out of Idaho, California. I'm telling y'all, you're pushing these white folk and you're pushing them. Your long-legged Mac Daddy's pushing them and pushing them and pushing them. And they're going to get, listen, you're going to push people to the point where they're not going to take it no more. These white folk are not going to take it. You're taking their tax money. You're closing down their jobs. You're shutting down their banks. You're telling them what they can and cannot do. You're giving billions of dollars to Acorn. You're taking their tax money and giving it to people to buy drugs. You're killing babies and you won't stop. You're telling lies and you're demoralizing our nation. You're destroying everything that has made this nation great. White folk getting ready to rise up. They don't want to take it no more. And I'm joining them. Oh, doggone it. I am.
Welcome back to another segment of The Shooting Bench, right here on the Survival Circle Radio Network. All right, and we are back. Welcome to The Shooting Bench again. It's Monday, the 22nd of August. And, you know, I've got a story here. There's a few other stories I may put on hold here for a little bit. Actually, well, I'm not going to take a break right at the top of the hour. I got my breaks all screwed up here. Since we're doing 2 hours, I'm going to try to do a song or something every 20 minutes or so instead of the top and the bottom of the hour. But we'll just play it by ear and just let the chips fall where they may. But when I was a kid, I didn't actually meet the guy until I was probably 15, maybe 16 years old. There was a guy that lived near Grants, New Mexico, who was a true, honest to goodness, Old West, frontiersman icon of the Old West there. His name was Gus Rainey. Gus Rainey was, they just had another, if you do a search on the internet for him, you'll come up with it with oodles and gobs of stories. He is truly a legend, or was. He's dead now. Been dead for a while. I met him a couple of times. He was a guy that if you looked in his eyes, there was two things that was readily apparent. One of them was, I don't know so far if I'd go so far as to say I'm lonely, but I would say without hesitation that looking into his eyes, at least in my mind, I could see that I could be the most loyal friend that you've ever had. Now, I never knew him well enough to get that, to be that friend, or to even be close, but, because I'd only met him twice. But his eyes were very telling. The other thing that I saw in his eyes was that, if you screw me around, I will cut your head off and put it on a stick. It was very obvious that you did not want to get on the bad side of Gus Rainey. You read some of the stuff. There are hundreds of pages of stuff that you can read about Gus Rainey. Very, very colorful life. Apparently, he says they don't know when he was born. They say he was, it would have been a whole lot more comfortable living in the 19th century than the 20th century. And I'm pretty sure that I would have too. But, a lot of the old timers in that part of the country, and back in those days, it was called Valencia County. It's Cibola. They call it Cibola. It's actually Cibola County. But, a lot of people back there knew Gus. Now, he stayed by himself a lot. Didn't come to town very often. Maybe once a month. And legend had it, and my Uncle Ace knew him pretty well. The guy that one of my uncles had talked about on Amy's show there. He knew him pretty well, knew exactly where he lived. I knew where he lived. I can show you today where he lived. It's out on 117, State Highway 117. Back then it was all dirt. It was all dirt all the way from Interstate 40 all the way to Highway 32, which is a road that goes between Quemado, New Mexico, and I believe over to Fence Lake. But anyway, 117 would run from I-40 all the way down there. Back then, it was a gravel road the whole way. And I can show you, that's where you may have heard of... Oh, stop. You may have heard of the York Ranch. Huge ranch out there. That's out on 117. And I can show you Gus's old house out there. Now, legend had it that there were some dogs. He had several dogs. I know he had the dogs tied up because I saw him driving by his house. Now, whether or not the pattern was what everybody said it was, I don't know. But apparently these dogs wouldn't even let Gus through there. You had to know the trail to get through, and he moved them. That was it. You couldn't just see where the chain, you know, where the patterns ended, you know, where the chain allowed the dogs to go, because he moved them on. And once it started to be apparent that there was a pattern there, he would move them so it would cover up the current trail and allow you to make a new one through there. And he moved them pretty regularly. And he couldn't even get through them himself. He made no attempt to. He had one dog that he carried. He had an old blue Ford Bronco. And where I got the idea of putting back in my younger days, I got the idea of putting a handgun on the steering column of my truck. And I got that from Gus Rainey. He had a Ruger Blackhawk in a leather holster strapped onto his steering column in that Bronco with, radiator hose clamps. And that was where I learned to do that. Gus was, I thought he was a good old guy. But I can see where he had such a colorful past and such a, I'm not sure what you'd call it there, but the people that didn't like him would call him everything but a child of God. They called him a murderer and liar, a con man, back shooter, thief. But those of us that actually knew him didn't really see it that way. They said in this one story, they said that parents told their children that he was the boogeyman who would put them in sacks and carry them away if they were bad or didn't go to bed on time or whatever. Didn't get the room cleaned, whatever. The boogeyman, that was Gus Rainey. Gus Rainey is definitely a true-to-life, honest-to-God Western legend. And I knew him. And I say I knew him. I met him twice. We did talk a little bit, and I enjoyed visiting with him. I didn't know him. I've driven by his house many, 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 many times, but I've never stopped. I was just always, on the way to somewhere. There was never any way to tell if he was home or not, and always had, always believed the legend about the dog, so I didn't want him to go up there and knock on the door. So, anyway. But a lot of people remember him as just the opposite of what the publisher to the newspaper around there called him. They said he was a true gentleman, told stories to kids, removed his hat and bowed to the ladies, and when they entered the post office or any of the surrounding stores there. And when they asked how old he was, he said he didn't exactly know. He liked to tell people he was born on November 11th, 1882, but he had no means to prove it. He had no birth certificate. That would have made him 101 in 1983. I remember when he died. As a matter of fact, I still have in there in my scrapbook, in my Army scrapbook, I still have today the newspaper clippings out of the Grant's Daily Beacon, of the day that he died. There's two long stories in there about him and claiming to be over 100 years old. And that's what he had on his driver's license that the year that he died, is that he was 101 years old. They say, although they don't have any way to prove it either, they say that it was more likely that he was born on November 11th, 1902, since he told the U.S. census taker that he was 38 in 1940. Now, there's no way to prove that either, so nobody knows. He was born in Uvalde, Texas, moved his family to New Mexico in 1908. So, if he moved his family to New Mexico in 1908, it seems unlikely that he would be born in 1902. That would make him 6 years old. Oh, no, it says moved. I'm sorry. It says moved with his family, not moved his family. So they said they don't know. He evidently, legend has it that he's killed quite a few men. And don't mind telling what he tells everybody. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. They say they don't know if he killed his first man when he was only 12 or as one of the descendants of the Hidalgo County Sheriff says, he robbed a bank in Lordsburg, taking three boxes of Double Eagles as loot. They don't know if either of those two things are true. They do know that in an interview in 1977, that Gus told a reporter that he had worked as a cowboy from the age of 9 and began rustling cattle when he was 13. Says that he illegally drove cattle into the United States for $60 in gold while poaching baby eagles for $15 each in his teenage years. Now, when you say poaching baby eagles, why do you get paid for that? He sold them to the Indians. The Indians use them for ceremonial headdresses and stuff like that. Now, the Indians can kill an eagle and get away with it. They don't have any restrictions whatsoever. But when a white man kills them and sells them to the Indians, that is way not a good thing to do. Not at all healthy for you. See, Molly's joined us there. Welcome, Molly. Good to see you back in here. So, anyway, they said he committed a far more serious crime in 1932 Let's see if he was 38 in 1940. Okay. He said he'd leased a goat farm near Cliff, New Mexico. Cliff is over there due south of Luna and Reserve, New Mexico, on 180. A neat little town. Real little town. But there's some interesting people around there still today. But anyway, he sold this, he leased this goat farm to a man named R.B. Weatherford. And I guess Gus got pretty upset when he found out that he was working the farm with another guy who had previously argued with something as trivial as the ownership of a hat. Gus went to Weatherford's cabin and entered with his Colt 45 drawn, and he shot both men. The Faulkner, the guy that he didn't like, that I argued about the hat with, died of his wounds. He was shot in the neck. The other guy managed to survive. Gus turned himself in, stood trial in 1932, in September 1932, pleaded self-defense, claimed that the guy had gone for his gun, which he had hidden under a pillow. The guy that lived said that his friend never had time to get to his gun, was in fact tying his shoes when Gus charged in and went to blazing away at him. So, whether his story was true or not doesn't matter. The jury, and I've told people, when you go in to testify on your own behalf or someone else's, appearance makes a difference. And I'm sure that that had something to do with the jury believing Weatherford's version of the story. I mean, it was his word against Gus's, so. But the jury took only 33 minutes to find Gus guilty. They sentenced him to 2 to 7 years in prison. He served only 22 months and was paroled and released in August of 1934. And no one knows why the governor at the time gave him a full pardon 2 years after that. That's very, very unusual. But anyway, when he got out of jail, the authorities ran him out of town, ran him out, plumb out of the county, out of Grant County when he was released from jail. So, the date, they don't know the date of this either, but he married a lady named Myrtle Watkins, and they'd settled in southwest New Mexico in early 20th century. Myrtle was born in 1899, making her either 3 years older than Gus or 17 years younger, one or the other, depending on when Gus was born. He called her Sugarfoot, and they had 4 kids together. 2 of the boys were given clever first name. One of them was Hale, and one of them was Sleet. Last name Rainey. Get it? Hale Rainey, Sleet Rainey. Uh-huh. The other 2 children had more traditional names. They're Orville and Ethel. I'm not sure Orville and Ethel is all that. I guess that's pretty traditional back in those days. I've known a couple of guys named Orville, but never knew an Ethel, though, that I can remember. Anyway, while they were in prison, the wife and the kids were left completely destitute. They lived in a cave with only a tarp to cover the entrance. And once he got his parole and was no longer welcome in Grant County, he and the family moved out to Grants, which was then Valencia County. And actually, he was a little ways, 40 miles south of Grants, out on 117, where the house that I know where is. The property could only be reached at that time over rough, primitive roads. Now, it was pretty primitive when I knew him, but it wasn't that bad. It was a gravel out to get pretty near to his house. And then, not long after that, and this had something to do with him dying at a later point, but they just got settled into their ranch when the 13-year-old and the 15-year-old, Hale and Orville, left on Saturday, October 16th. They went out to cut fence posts. And the kids the boys didn't return that night. One of the horses came back without a rider the next day. So Gus went out and started looking for him, and took a couple of neighbors with him. He found his sons drowned at the bottom of a stock tank out there. Both boys were fully clothed. So, you know, it's unlikely, it's highly unlikely. I have done my share of skinny dipping in stock tanks out there, and it is immensely unlikely that these boys just decided to jump in and cool off and, fully clothed. However, and they said it was also way too cold for him to do that. So police say that one of them, and I don't know how they determine which one, they said Hale may have somehow fallen in and Orville had drowned trying to save his younger brother. That was strictly a wild-ass guess there. But state police said they found no evidence of foul play. So maybe it's true, maybe nobody knows. Nobody will ever know. But Gus actually met his son, the other one that lived. He had a son and a daughter that lived. What was his son's name? I think it was, it says it was, let's see, Orville and Hale. So what was the other one? Sleet. Let me go back up here. What was the names here? Orville, Ethel, Hale, and Sleet. So Sleet would have been the one that was still alive. So I know it was a grandson. It was a grandson. It wasn't his son. He was pretty damn old when I knew him. So it was his grandson. I believe his name was Clyde. I don't remember for sure. And I know that Clyde went to prison for also killing eagles and selling them the feathers to the Indians out there. And that was while I was still living there. So, anyway, Gus had other ideas about what happened. He was convinced that one of his old enemies were involved in the death, so he intended to hunt the guy down that he suspected of killing his sons. He was gone for 4 days when people got a little concerned, and there was rumors that a body was found full of bullet holes not far from the water tank where Gus had discovered his sons. Now, there was people that had assumed that it was Gus, but they never found out for sure. By December, the chief feared that Gus had died in the woods out there. And so the police chief and 5 state police officers searched that area. They finally found Gus and his wife and the 2 surviving kids in his brother-in-law Clarence Watkins' house. And this was off in a canyon, you know, it doesn't matter where it was. But Gus said he was surprised when the three of the cops showed up, told him he was assumed missing or dead. Gus claimed that he wasn't missing, just looking for a job, hoping to settle down near Mogollon to recover from the town. Mogollon, if you remember, is over by, it's north of Glenwood, just barely north of Glenwood, New Mexico, between Glenwood and Reserve. There's some neat country back there. It's all a ghost town back in there now. It is so, so cool back in that area. It's about, if I remember right, it's about 20, 30 miles off of the highway, off of 180, off to the east there. Pretty neat area. If you ever get a chance to get out there, it is definitely worth the drive out there. But they say the story of the kid's death might have ended there, but said there were rumors that transpired at the water tank, and said according to the rumors, Gus had drowned his own sons when he'd caught them drinking liquor. Well, I didn't know Gus well, but I highly, highly doubt that. Certainly it's a possibility, but I very much doubt it. But and he led the search party that went looking for the boys to cover up his activity, cover up what he did there. There was another story about the kid's death that Gus not only killed the boys but later dressed their bodies in their Sunday clothes and took to the nearby ice caves. Now, I've told you about the ice caves before. That is west of Grants, out on Highway 53. And the ice caves is just exactly what it says it is. You walk down in there a little ways, And any time of the year, any time of the day, there's ice down there. It's back in the, it's right at Bandera Crater by the volcano. And he walked back in there just, I don't remember what it is, 20, 40 yards maybe. It's not very far. And you run into pure, solid, crystal clear, rock hard ice. They've got it blocked off now, and you can still go in there. It's still a tourist attraction. You can go in there, but it's fenced off where you can't get to the ice because people were trying to steal chunks of it and carving their name in it and all that stuff. Matter of fact, there's the store there still today is the old bar that stood there back in the 1800s. Undoubtedly, Gus Rainey has been in that bar many times. And in a display case in there, they found a, not that it has anything to do with Gus Rainey, but they found an old Colt 45, an old Colt single action army, all rusted shut and everything, that they had found in the lava rock right near where that bar was built. But that was a very, very popular bar back in the day because it was a place where you could always go any time of the day or night and any time of the year and get cold milk and cold sarsaparilla and cold beer, because they just walked right down in the ice cave, have everything stored down there at a place where it was about 45 degrees, and people would travel for miles around to go to this little bar out in the middle of absolutely no freaking where in the world, nothing close to it, but you could get a cold beer. And everybody knows that attraction. But anyway, later on, after the jail, after the kids, you know, all the rumors and stuff died down, then he went to work for some of the uranium companies around there. There was a guy that the guy that discovered uranium in Grants, this was in 1950, and I've heard this story about this guy many times too, and his name was Paddy Martinez, P-A-D-D-Y, not T-T. Paddy Martinez discovered uranium around there in 1950. And they started opening up all these mine sites and everything, paying good, good money, lots of employees. This was the, I don't know if it still is considered the uranium capital of the world, but for many years, that area, Grants, New Mexico, was considered the uranium capital of the world. And as long as the United States needed uranium for its atomic weapons and whatnot, then and all up until, I don't remember when everything closed down. I think it was in the 80s sometime when they started closing things down and people started leaving Grants. So 30 to 40 years, it run pretty hard there. But anyway, they got Gus to, his reputation helped him get a job there as a reserve deputy in 1956. And there's a picture of this guy, of Gus Rainey, with his badge pinned over his heart and his gun in his holster and his handcuffs hanging from his belt. Just a real Old West image there in 1956. Said he claimed to have served as a U.S. Marshal, a town marshal, a county sheriff, a chief deputy sheriff, a rough rider, and a bodyguard for Senator Clinton B. Anderson, forest ranger, and an undercover agent for the U.S. Forest Secret Service. How much, if any, of that's true, we have no way of knowing. But my stepdad told me a story one time, and I don't know if it was true. I mean, it was, I think that he told it to me as truth. He wouldn't have known. But whether he got it as true or not, I don't know. But there's lots of stories of Gus tracking people down and bringing them in. And he said, he don't know how many people he had killed, but he said he never killed anybody that didn't deserve it. But my stepdad told me that he had gone up on Mount Taylor that some of the gas companies around there had a problem with stealing drip. For those of you that have been in the gas industry, you know that there's, in the old gas wells, there was a byproduct come off of the, at the wells there. And if you knew how to do it, you could go and get this drip, which was a very low grade gas. You couldn't burn it in modern engines, but back in those days, we'd burn it all the time. Stealing drip was a big deal. So they wanted to find out who was doing this. It seemed to be quite an epidemic there. So he was gone for a while, and he come back into town, as story has it, and he went up to the people that he worked for him. He says, said, "I've got him tied up to a tree up there. Do you want me to kill him?" And so they said, no, well, thank you, Gus. They paid him, and they went and picked him up, according to legend there. But neat old guy. Lots of stories about Gus Rainey. It was a pretty interesting guy to know there. There's a whole lot more about that, but anyway, according to the papers, he died at 101 years old, and that would have been I guess December 6th or December 7th of 1983. December 6th, I guess. Yeah, December 6th, 1983. And anyway, there's so much more about Gus Rainey, so maybe we'll get into more of it one of these days. But there's one thing. Let's see. There was a 1973 shooting that occurred in a quarrel over a beef carcass on the Rainey Ranch. Mr. Rainey was not wounded in either incident. All right, let's move on to bigger and better things. I just really wanted to share that because I thought Gus Rainey was a pretty neat guy.
these things that won't change, come what may. But my good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on. I'll look for you if I'm ever back this way. I may go out to Alberta, weather's good there in the fall. Got some friends that I could go to working for. Still, I wish you'd change your mind if I asked you one more time. But we've been through that a hundred times or more. If I get there before the snow flies and things are going good, you could join me if I'd send you down the fair. But if you wait until it's when, it would do no good. For the wind sure can blow cold way out there. Strong winds that blow low, seven seas that run high, all these things that won't change, come what
change, come what may.
But my good times are all gone, and I'm bound for moving on. I'll look for you if I'm never back this way.
Welcome back to another segment of the Shooting Bench, right here on the Survival Circle Radio Network. Okay, well, there's a story out of Germany today that I thought was pretty interesting. They're not only suggesting that their citizens stockpile food and water, they are telling them that that's what you have to do. They're saying the population will be, for the first time since the end of the Cold War, the German government has told people, they said the population, this is a quote, they said the population will be obliged to hold an individual supply of food for 10 days, there's quite a lengthy deal here. There's a 69-page report. It says they don't see an attack on Germany's territory, which would require a more conventional style of national defense. But this right here is very telling, I think. It said the precautionary measures demand that people, quote, prepare appropriately for a development that could threaten our existence and cannot be categorically ruled out in the future. And that was a quote out of that 69-page report there. The defense minister said earlier this month that the country lay in the crosshairs of terrorism and pressed for plans for the military to train more closely with police and preparing for potential large-scale militant attacks. That's a little on the concerning side, particularly if you live in Germany. But I think it's just one more thing that leads us, that should lead us to believe that our time is coming. That it's just about, you know, as many, long as I've been saying this, and I've said this, what I'm about to say, 150 times, but, you know, for a long time, some of us have seen this coming and tried to prepare for it, and I've talked about it on the show for 10 years, and I've always felt that it was close, but as time goes on, I have never felt that it was this close. There's lots of speculation on the internet and on Facebook and one places. Of course, you may find this hard to believe, but Facebook's on the internet too. But lots of speculation out there that this election is going to be the end, that there's going to be so much violence that the martial law will be ushered in, and that'll be it. And I'm not going to, I refuse to say that that is impossible to happen. I think it is highly unlikely. As I've said before, logistically, it's going to be really tough to impose martial law on the entire nation. If they did, it would be mostly symbolic because there's no way they could enforce it. There's not enough UN troops. There's not enough of our troops that will, even if they called them all home, which they won't. I mean, they're not going to, the people that we have on foreign bases, they may be able to get some of them home. But even if they did, out of that, however many that they have on our soil, how many of them would actually help them to impose martial law? Now, I can see how they could do that with, if they claimed that there was a, let's say, an unstoppable epidemic of some type of a disease or a virus somewhere, and they said, if we don't stop this, if we don't get people under control, then the human race, or at least the American society, will be wiped out. And they could fake that, I think, pretty easily. And if they did, most of our soldiers would most of our soldiers would go for it, I think. That Kilogram, that small arms treaty that was signed, is absolutely toothless. It means nothing to us. It's not gonna affect anything. But if they decided, and Molly, they could be, there's a possibility, however unlikely, I think there's a possibility they could be testing it with that Zika virus. To impose martial law over the entire country, like I said, logistically would be a nightmare. I don't believe it could be done. But if they did do that, or tried to do it, as I've said before, I believe that they will try to do it. There's a damn mouse in here. Where's my 22? I'll be damned. How'd he get in here? Must have snuck in when I left the door open one time or something. I'll fix him. I'll bring my BB gun out here and I'll get him during the show. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put a hunk of cheese up there on that loft deal tomorrow evening, or Wednesday during the show, and I'll murder that mouse right here in front of God and everybody. I'll be darned. And the only way for him to get out is in a body bag, because there's no way to get in this building unless somebody left the door open. And that was BP, me. I won't do it again, though. What was I talking about? Oh, I think that, peanut butter, I know, Radio Doc. You've been there, done that. For those of you, I think I still have it on my YouTube channel. I don't remember for sure. But I caught a squirrel big old squirrel, in my kitchen. One time, we found out that he was getting in under the house, found out where he was going in from the outside, and he was coming up through a place where they had, you know, the heater was in a little crawl space, a little cellar type dungeon thing under the house there, and it didn't work very well. I was scared to death of using it with the kids in there, so we never did use it. We used a fireplace and a propane stove there. And we found some evidence that the squirrel was in there, and then one of the kids saw it. Oh, I know what it was. We walked around the corner one time, and that squirrel was there, and he just peeled out and turned around and slipped on that tile and couldn't run and looked like a cartoon character with his legs running 100 miles an hour, and he wasn't hardly moving. He finally got where he could get to moving there, and we seen him run in this good dive under this step and get in that place under the house. So he's trying to figure out what to do, and I set a figure four trigger for this. I took a crate, a fairly heavy metal crate, and set a figure four trigger under it and put some peanut butter on the trigger part of it, and come home later that day, and sure enough, we had caught him. However, he had kept hitting this. I couldn't believe it. He kept hitting this crate from inside. I don't know if he was doing it with his head or his shoulders or what he was doing, but he kept hitting it and moved it about 4 feet across the floor until the edge of it was hanging out over that step, and he jumped out and went under the house. So I said, well, I wonder if he'll fall for it twice. So we set the thing up again the next day, and I put some weight on top of it and put that figure four trigger in place again, peanut butter and the whole nine yards. Come back later that day, and there he was. We'd caught him. He couldn't move it because I had too much weight on it. And, he was mad. I don't know. I'll have to look at YouTube and see if I've still got that on there. He was so pissed. Made noises that I never heard a squirrel make before. And so I took a piece of sheet metal, piece of tin, you know, flat tin, and slid it underneath that crate so we could pick it up. Me and Wesley picked it up and took it out to the truck and drove him up on the mesa way up there behind the south of Farmington and turned him loose. We filmed the whole thing. And it was pretty. It was a lot of fun. It was pretty interesting, and it taught Wesley how to set figure four triggers and make traps in the event that somebody ever needed to, or if he ever needed to. Anyway, back to martial law. Could they do this nationwide? I don't believe they can. I firmly believe that they cannot do that. However, I think that they could do. There he is again. He didn't know I was in. He hears me talking. Now he stopped on the edge of the shelf. Wonder if I can hit him with my knife. Here he comes. All right, stand by. He's coming. I'm going to see if he's probably looking for a way out. He's probably getting hungry. There ain't nothing in here to eat. He's looking at me now. Let's see what he does. I'll keep talking here. What I think they might be able to do with martial law, I ain't no great knife thrower, but we're going to try it here in just a minute if he keeps coming down the edge of this rafter here. Is not be able to do it nationwide, but could they do it metropolitan areas? Could they take Phoenix? Could they take St. Louis, Los Angeles, Miami, you know, whatever? And then he's getting closer. Here he comes. All right. Here he comes. Nope, scared the hell out of him, but I didn't get him. That was dangerous. A knife came right back here on the table. Well, I'll have to fix that rascal. All right. And I think that if they did this in metropolitan areas like that, that eventually they could start luring. On paper, they could say that martial law was imposed all over the country. However, that would be absolutely impossible to enforce it. So if... I thought about using my glove. Actually, I thought about getting that 22 up there and shooting him, but I don't want to shoot a hole in my in my deal here. There would be no way to enforce it over the country, but if they did that in the metropolitan areas, eventually people would need to come in for, you know, medical supplies, insulin, food, information. Sooner or later, people would... the cities may try to rebel, Molly, but I don't think they'd have... They wouldn't have as much chance as a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. They could shut these cities down in a matter of minutes, actually. They could shut off the power. Once they shut off the power in Phoenix, those people are done. They're going to be done. They're going to be cooked in their own house. They try to do that in the summertime, or if they did do it in the summertime, they could control Phoenix in a hurry. They could get people under control most Ricky Tick when it's 125 degrees outside and they shut the power off. Molly, no. I really don't believe they would come up here or go to any small rural area. In the first place, it's not worth it to them. What would they gain? That's right, Kilogram. They shut the internet off. No Facebook, and that'd be the end of mankind as we know it. But what would they gain by coming up here? Look at the population. Look what they have to deal with. Look at the resources they would have to expend to do that. No, hell no, they're not going to come up here. They will wait for us to go to them. When it gets to a point where kids are starving and everything, where people that haven't prepared, people will go to them, and they will accept their chip, their number, their tattoo, their whatever. They'll get in the soup lines. And a great many people will do that. A great many people. There'll be some of us, hopefully, that have prepared to a point that we can be self-sufficient, not only prepared with supplies, but prepared with knowledge and training that we can do stuff without. We may have to go back to pretty primitive way of living. But some of us can do that. Some of us assume we can do that. Some of us have no damn intention of trying to do that. But, you know, there'll be some of us that will be able to make it. And it'll be an interesting time. You know, one of the bad things where I see everybody is joking about Facebook and stuff on the chat room here. But you know what? It's going to be... Can we get along without it? Absolutely. Of course we can. When I go to the woods, you know, I go up shooting, go, so I don't miss it a bit. I don't care. I don't even think about it. When I'm down within in Wi-Fi range and stuff, you know, I'm on it pretty frequently. And it helps with, you know, with the liberty movement and some of the things I do with the business and things like that. But the biggest thing about it is what we're doing right now. Is I'm able to sit here and talk to friends. It'll go out on podcast tomorrow. And, you know, I'll be able to continue to communicate, even if it's through, you know, just through an archive. And we visit a lot with friends. We make friends. I have met many people personally and that I would have never met had I not been on Facebook. People are worried about Facebook, about privacy and stuff. That's ridiculous. If you don't want that stuff on there, don't put it on there. You can still have an account and be able to visit with people and meet people. I have no idea how many people I've met because of Facebook. And the majority of them have become good friends. You know, they were friends on Facebook to start with. And not that, of course, if I'd have never had Facebook, I'd have never met them, wouldn't miss them, wouldn't make any difference, but we would miss them now. The chat room here and Facebook, the radio show and all this stuff, I stay in contact with Radio Doc and quite a number of other people as far as that goes. But, Kilogram, you know, I've never met Kilogram, but Radio Doc I have met. There's people over Yakima Glock and Longslide and B2 Basic and Tampico Scout and you know, a bunch of those people. I've met those people. You see Mama Grizzly in here the other night. I've met these people, and I can stay in contact with them through the chat room or through you know, through Facebook and whatever, and I think it's a neat deal. We will miss that when the time comes. You know, one day we're going to get up and, you know, whether the grid's down or whatever the case may be, the internet shut off or whatever. And, there's going to be no more radio show. There's going to be no more getting together in the evenings and having fun and talking crap, you know. So, we all, you know, there's a bunch of people get on the chat room and we all enjoy visiting with each other. And then one day, poof, it'll be gone. And some of us will miss that. We'll miss being able to talk to people and everything. But, you know, it que sera, sera, whatever it is, it'll be gone. So, Molly, you know, maybe, maybe not. If the internet is down because of lack of power, that's going to affect some radios. If it's an EMP, it's going to affect the overwhelming majority of radios. So we may or may not be able to stay in contact by ham radio. As a matter of fact, where you are right now, we could talk now. I don't know if you have your license yet, Molly, but if you don't, you need to get it in gear and get it done. You know, get with me and I'll show you a real quick and easy way to do that and have your license probably, or at least have take your test and everything and pass it in probably 2 weeks or less. So you and I could stay in contact with each other easily. I know where you're at and I know the repeaters that you could reach from where you are, and we could talk to each other on a regular basis, particularly after the poop hits the fan. So, yeah, Kilogram, if you want to do that without going to jail on ham radio, unless you want to do everything everything by code in very short communications, then yeah, you're gonna get a license. And I don't care. So what? I mean, it's not a they. I understand the sentiment for not being able to or why can't you talk on airways without a license? Well, same reason that they won't let you drive on the highways without a license, I guess. Even though the Supreme Court has ruled that you don't have to have a driver's license, the law has not changed yet, saying that you have to. So that would be something that people are going to have to challenge and see if it holds up. There are some frequencies that you can talk on pretty safely, but if you want to get any distance, you're going to have to go through a repeater. And once you start messing with repeaters, you're going to get caught, because the ham radio community is a very tight-knit community, and there are people out there that their sole purpose in life is to listen to people that are talking illegally through repeaters or on ham, period, and reporting them to the FCC. So if you want to communicate any distance at all and go through a repeater, you really don't have any logical, feasible choice except to get a permit. So I've got mine, and when poop hits the fan, who cares? Doesn't matter. All that'll be water under the bridge. It allows us right now to practice our communication skills with our radios, so that we can be well versed in the use of it when the poop does hit the fan. Yeah, Mini Men Pin, there's you can look it up. There's a group of people. I shouldn't say it's a group, but there are a certain percentage of people that have ham radios Any ham operator will report you, or most any of them, will report you if they find you talking on any of the ham frequencies without a license. However, like I said, there's a group, I think they call them, and I don't remember what it stands for, but I think it's either OO or CC or something like that, and that stands for something, operator something, I don't remember. But Matty Buck, you don't need to get a license, honey. You got, if Lima has his, it covers family members in the same house. So what you could do, if he had a radio in his truck, say, and you were at home, you could be whatever his number is, mobile and base or something like that. But you are not required to have a license. You are required to follow all the rules and everything that the license, that the law says you have to, but you do not have to have a license as long as you're operating with his equipment. So you're good to go. Now I forgot what I was talking about. I do that all the time, get sidetracked. But there are some frequencies. Oh, I know what I was talking about, the OOs or whatever. There's a group of people, and that really is. I'm not saying that as a joke. It really is their purpose in life. Is to official observer. Thank you, Anon, whoever you are, 34 or 54. Official observer. Those people, their sole function in life is to listen for people that they think are violating FCC rules and turning them in. So it's a dangerous thing to do, and that's really that you can get by with a lot of stuff pretty easy on hand. But if you get caught, depending on what the violation was, it could be a relatively bad thing for you. The worst thing, you know, just getting caught talking on 2 meter without a license is really not that big a deal. There might be a little fine, probably just a slap on the wrist, and if you do it the second time, then they'll lower the boom on you. But if you get caught going through repeaters, or if you get caught on military or law enforcement channels or something like that, they could make it pretty hard on you. So getting a license really is not that bad of a deal. Now, kilogram, how about CB compared to ham? Well, you know, good, strong. If you want a CB tuned up, you send it to Radio Doc. I promise you that. He's as good as they come. But if you have a good tuned up CB and a little power behind it and whatnot, not that that's legal. I can't tell you to do that, but CB talks pretty well. The problem with CB is it's so crowded. You can have more power, way more power than your ham radio has, but your ham radio is going to talk much further under most conditions. The thing about CB is you can often catch what they call skip and talk skip anywhere from, you know, I've sat in Farmington, New Mexico and talked to Oklahoma and several places in California and Nevada and all these places. But it's not predictable. I can't do it just any time. It's only when the weather conditions are right and certain times of the day. So there's no way I could say, well, I'm going to get a hold of Kilogram over in Texas tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. I need to let him know that I'm coming over there. I can't do that. It's just the luck of the draw. So that's the bad thing about CB. With ham, that's right, Radio Doc, just more power. See, that's another thing about CB is you can get what they call a DX radio, an import radio, and it has a whole, I'm looking at one sitting across the room from me right now that's turned on, sitting there waiting for somebody to come pay it some attention, has 480 channels. All right, regular CB operators, you are not allowed to talk on one of those channels except the regular 40 that's assigned to CB. However, if you have a license, I can talk on any of those except CB using up to 1,500 watts of power. So there are definitely some benefits to getting that permit. Molly, in a grid down situation, could I run my ham? Yes, I could, unless It was an EMP situation. I could run it off of, well, actually, I've got four radios that are stored in Faraday cages that I'll be pulling out after the EMP. Two of them I'll pull out right away. Two of them will stay in there in case somebody decides to do it again. My thought with an EMP, if I was someone that was going to set off an EMP over America, I would do one, and I would wait 24 hours and do another one. Because as soon as that's done, people like me that have put back a bunch of stuff to survive this, they drag it out, and then they say, okay, let's hit them again a day later, and then all that stuff gets fried. So I've got two radios that I will unseal immediately, two that I won't open until after 24 hours after the first one. So, but just a grid down situation that's not an EMP, absolutely. I can take the base radio that I have in here sitting right behind me and hook that up to my truck and keep on. Actually, I have a small one in my truck. It's just that this one behind me puts out a whole lot more power, courtesy of a very good friend of mine that lives a few miles from me, has helped me out with this, helped me get going with it. So, there's no way to prepare for every possible contingency out there. We'll do the best we can, and if it works, great. If it don't, well, we'll always wish it should have. All right, well, it's been fun, and I've enjoyed. We've bounced around all over the place, talked about all kinds of crap tonight. One last thing on these radios, and I mentioned this, I think Friday, maybe Thursday, or maybe Wednesday, I don't remember, one day last week. I talked about a new radio that Bofang has out, and I want to remind you of this again, particularly for those of you that have licenses. This radio costs a little more, it's still quite affordable. But they've added, it's a tri-band, and they've added another line of frequencies to it. They've put the 1.25 meter band in there, which is your 222 to 225.99 megahertz. It still has all the VHF channels and your 400 to 520 UHF. And now they've added the 1.25 meter. The only downside to this I see is for that new band there, you have to have a different antenna. Your dual band antenna that will take care of VHF and UHF will not do the 1.25 meter. That's not to say that they won't come out with one at some point. Maybe an antenna with the flip of a switch or something. But at this point, that's not possible. These radios through Amazon are $65. They list for $110. Of course, I think they just put that on there, but that's a neat deal. That adds a whole nother realm of communication possibilities, and your general license will allow you to talk on 1.25. I'm not sure if the technician's license will or not. I'd have to whip out my little chart here and see. Matter of fact, while we're sitting here, I'm just going to whip out my little chart and see, and I'll let you guys know. If you'll give me just a couple of minutes, I've got this chart on my phone here, and let me see if I can find it real quick. And it is, I know I've got it. All right, what the heck? I had it on here. Oh, I remember what happened. I had this factory reset on my phone the other day and just destroyed every cotton picking thing. But I can bring this up real quick. At least I think I can. Radio net list, scanner and ham frequencies, ham license, New Mexico repeaters. Right there it is. All right, let me download this and get it back on the phone here. It'll take just a second. Or maybe a couple of seconds, or 5 seconds, or 10, 15 seconds, or something like that. All right, it says it's on here. There it is, right there. Okay. 1.25. Where in the heck is it? There's 2 meter. There's, okay, there it is. Got it. All right. You know what? This, it doesn't tell me whether, is there anybody on, let me see on the chat for somebody that's mentioned that already. Tech license part, okay. We've got somebody that's anonymous there that's kind of radio savvy. Tech license part of 10 meters up. All right, I'm assuming. Okay, there it is. USA Amateur Radio HF band. So I'm assuming that that is the 10 meter 6-2-222-440-912-40. I don't think text license covers all that, does it? Let's see here. Extra voice, general voice. Let me see if I can find my other band plan here. Just to double check and make sure. Because I don't remember. Ham license, ham repeaters. I've got all of this crap. Let's try this one. All right. Got another one downloading here, and we'll check it. I have got so much crap on my phone, you would not believe it. There is Anonymous 3454. Give me a hint. Give me a clue. Who are you? I'm guessing it might be somebody I know. It may be Huey Tuft. I'm not sure. Okay, it says the tech license does cover the 220. So, yep, tech in general. So, yeah, with the technicians only, you could cover all those, so that's good to know. I don't look at this very often. Yeah, it covers the 23 centimeter, 33 centimeter, 70 centimeter, 1.25, 2 meter, 6 meter, and that looks like it, except for some Morse code stuff there. All right, well, you've really got me to rambling now, so I think I need to ramble on out of here, and hopefully I can get my archives running here before I got 51 seconds to do that. So I'm going to get out of here. We'll see you Wednesday. Don't forget to join me, this, especially for the second hour Wednesday. Doc and I are going to talk about a beloved handgun that most Americans should have had one at some point in their life. So we'll see you then. Thanks for joining me again. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Shooting Bench. Join me Monday and Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, and again on Fridays from 7 to 10 for the Shooting Bench. Good night, and thanks for joining me. Says it all.